This is Viewpoint with attorney and author Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is a one-hour open line talk show confronting the issues of America's heart and home. To express your viewpoint, please call 804-754-1988. That's 804-754-1988. And now with today's edition of Viewpoint, here is Chuck Crismeyer.
A series of headlines coming from Israel today telling us a story that few would have believed would take place, especially the way that it's taking place now in the Middle East. It seems that the Middle East is in an uproar right now. Some are celebrating and others are wondering what in the world has happened and what's going to happen. For instance, the Spanish Prime Minister now has attacked Israel and declared Israel to be a genocidal state during a parliamentary debate. It has caused an uproar throughout Spain and also in Israel. Then, in addition to that, Israel is at risk being outbid in Trump's Middle East marketplace. That's coming from the Jerusalem Post today. Israel must rethink itself, asserting itself to Washington, not through nostalgia or goodwill, but through enhanced defense and intelligence cooperation that benefits the U.S. economy. In other words, money has become the big issue. It seems as Donald Trump, our president, has gone across the seas to Saudi Arabia and then to Qatar and who knows where else, also by relationship to Syria. It seems that there are negotiations everywhere with those that have not been friends to the Jewish people. Then in addition to that, the Jerusalem Post announced today, Trump says the U.S. should take over Gaza, the Gaza Strip, and turn it into a freedom zone. Really? And then this article, Gulf diplomatic sources debate if Trump will announce U.S. recognition of a Palestinian state. Things are swirling. Speculation is swirling over this announcement on a Palestinian state. Is that indeed on the books? And what does it mean? What does all this mean for the future of Israel, the future of the United States, the future of the world? Well, today on Viewpoint, we're going to have a very open conversation with Josh Hammer. He has written a book called Israel and Civilization: The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. This is a big deal, friends. As you know, we have talked frequently here on this program about Israel. Even in my book, King of the Mountain, the whole first third of the book is about establishing the history of Israel vis-a-vis the Temple Mount. That also needs to be talked about here today. But here's an interesting thing taken right directly from Josh Hammer's new book. He says, the phenomenon of erudite Christian Hebraists using their knowledge of the Torah was not limited to Britain. The pilgrims who sailed across the Atlantic on the Mayflower eventually established Plymouth Colony and viewed their journey through the prism of the Hebrew Bible. In fact, they viewed themselves as a new Israel, crossing their own version of the Red Sea in hopes of better fulfilling God's laws. William Bradford, who was on the Mayflower, signed the Mayflower Compact and later served as the second governor of the Plymouth Colony, was himself partially literate in the Hebrew language, which he described as that most ancient language and holy tongue in which the law and oracles of God were written. In fact, Bradford believed that after his death, he would then speak the most ancient language, Hebrew, with God and the angels in the world to come. Who would have ever believed it? And who would have ever remembered, by the way, in all of the to-do about anti-Semitism and so on, that engraved in bas relief above the Supreme Court justices is the Ten Commandments delivered from Mount Sinai? Who in the world would ever believe these things today? But they're true. And what do they mean? And what is the end result? What are the implications now as we're sitting here, perhaps on the near edge of a new world order? What in the world is going on? Josh Hammer joining us, an attorney who also is involved in so many other things. Very, very interesting writer. Josh, it's good to have you on the program.
It's a pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you give us a little bit of, you know, you're coming as sort of an expert witness, and as we lawyers are prone to do, we want to make sure that we qualify you as an expert witness to talk about this subject. So you are Jewish by birth and by religious persuasion, are you not?
Yes, I am an observant Jew at that. I was raised in a more secular setting. My personal story actually weaves its way all throughout this book. But today I am not merely Jewish, but I'm also an observant Jew. My wife was actually born in Israel. Most of her family still lives in Israel. Her oldest brother, actually, my oldest brother-in-law, lives just a few miles from the border with Gaza. So I definitely eat, live, and breathe this issue, that is for sure.
All right. Now, qualifying so that we understand the conversation here as we go on, we almost need a bit of a glossary to understand some of the terms for our listeners. But there are a variety of, shall we say, orders of Jewish folk, even at the religious end of things, just like there are of professing Christians. And so you have at the top Orthodox Jews, perhaps Hasidic Jews, and then you have the conservative Jews. And in this country, we would think conservative, well, that means really conservative, but not necessarily so. And then you have the Reform Jews, and then you have the total seculars beyond that. Is that a pretty good framework?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty accurate. There's a fourth offshoot that, if you want to call that, called Reconstructionist Judaism.
Oh yes, Well, we have Reconstructionist Christianity too.
Right. So, I mean, they're kind of at the, shall we say, the lower end of the observance totem pole, would be a polite way of saying it, along with Reform Judaism, but. Look, I mean, I am myself someone who grew up in a largely assimilated Reform Jewish setting. That was kind of what I grew up, but I have moved quite far away from that. I actually have
is what we in the Christian community would call liberals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mainline and liberals. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Correct. So the foundational claim of Reform Judaism, which tragically, in my opinion, is the most predominant of the strands of Judaism in America, that I genuinely find that to be tragic. Mm-hmm. But its foundational assertion is that Jewish law, the 613 commandments, they are not binding, that you can essentially pick and choose your own adventure novel there. And to me, when you are forsaking the law, you are forsaking the essence of what it means to be a Jew, of what it means to try to live as part of what the Book of Exodus refers to as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, to try mm-hmm. to do your duty per the Book of Isaiah chapter 42 to be a light unto the nations.
Right.
You cannot get that without the law, but unfortunately Reformed Judaism does that. But I myself, at this point in my life, you know, you can say observant Jew, Orthodox Jew, any of
all
these
right.
terms.
All right, well, that helps us to understand now our conversation for those who are listening in today. So much to talk about. You and I could probably talk for about 5 days about this. We have about 45 minutes left. We'll talk about that in great detail. Friends, stay tuned. This is Viewpoint.
Once upon a time, children could pray and read their Bibles in school. Divorces were practically unknown, as was child abuse. In our once great America, virginity and chastity were popular virtues, and homosexuality was an abomination. So what happened in just one generation? Hi, I'm Chuck Chrismeyer, and I urge you to join me daily on Viewpoint, where we discuss the most challenging issues touching our hearts and homes. Could America's moral slide relate to the Fourth Commandment?
Listen to Viewpoint on this radio station or anytime at saveus.org.
Welcome back to Viewpoint, friends. I'm Chuck Chrismeyer. It's conversation with ever-increasing conviction, talk that transforms. We're not here just to be information dispensers, but also to use information in such a way that it brings transformation in our individual lives, our families, and yes, indeed, in our country. And, of course, that is the foundational reason why Josh Hammer has written this book, Israel and Civilization. Josh, give us a quick opening statement from one lawyer to another, considering that I'm representing the jury on the other end. Give us a quick opening statement as to what you're trying to accomplish and to communicate with this book.
Sure. So the book fundamentally accepts the premise, especially in the aftermath of the horrific pogrom of October 7th, 2023. The book accepts the premise that we are at a civilizational crossroads. But as a lawyer, as you said, I like to ask the most important questions of defining who we are. So when we say that we are at a civilizational crossroads,
right,
it's important to define what is our civilization, what is Western civilization, this term that gets batted around quite frequently. And I essentially argue in the book that Western civilization is largely coextensive with the Bible and our biblical inheritance. And
I would agree with that 1,000%.
Yeah, and I argue that Western civilization begins with God's revelation to Moses and the Israelites there, and the giving of the original law, Moses standing at the base of Mount Sinai. And if you accept and agree that we're at a civilizational crossroads, and in the book I identify three separate forces that are seeking to subjugate us in the West. I call them wokeism, Islamism, and global neoliberalism in no particular order, then it stands to reason that we have to be confident in who we are in order to have a fighting chance to turn back the tide. So the book is essentially calling for a Jewish-Christian ecumenical project of nationalist and biblical restoration. That is really the project of the book.
All right, interesting. Now, I don't much care for Woodrow Wilson, but he did make an interesting statement. He said, "He who doesn't know what he is does not know what he's doing or what he's going to do." And it has to do with our country, a nation that doesn't know what it is, does not know what it was, and doesn't know what it's trying to do. And I agree with that. We don't know what we're trying to do because we don't know who we are. To use bad English, we don't know who we is. And so we're kind of at that point, because whether it's within the Jewish circles in this country, which you said are predominantly Reform, which means politically and spiritually liberal, then you couple that with the Christian involvement, which has become increasingly liberal. Even those within the broader evangelical community have drifted much toward the liberal, just as Orthodox Jews have drifted toward Reform Judaism. So we see these things happening in America, which is, shall we say, the heart of the West. So where is our hope? What defines the crossroads that we're at?
Well, look, I am a lawyer, as you now generously mentioned numerous times, and I'm also a student of the American founding, and I love American history. I'm actually born on Abraham Lincoln's birthday. He's my favorite figure in all of American history. And I think the American founders, and we are just blessed to live in their system of governance today. These are such amazing, genius men. I mean, they knew a thing or two
about the
projects they were building, and they knew a thing or two about whence they came in order to have a sense as to where they were going. And they placed a very, very firm thumb on the scale of the Bible and the biblical inheritance there. As I note in the book, it's not a quote from Aristotle or Cicero, and these were great men to be sure, but it's not a quote from Aristotle or Cicero that is inscribed on the outside of the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. Rather, it is Leviticus chapter 25,
right,
that shall proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants thereof. Thomas Jefferson, theologically heterodox man himself, even he had the common sense to suggest alongside Benjamin Franklin that the national seal of the United States would be Moses and the Israelites parting the Red Sea.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, they were not interested in pagan iconography. They were interested in the story, the enduring lessons, the morality, and so forth of the Bible. And not just abstract morality, but actual revealed religion. In fact, George Washington, in his farewell address, one of Washington's greatest speeches that he ever gave, he famously says that only religion, not just abstract spirituality or morality, but actual revealed religion, only that can be the indispensable safeguard of our values, justice, morality, and so forth from one generation to the next.
Well, John Adams said, you know, our country was, our government was made for moral and religious or Christian
Correct.
People and is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. So there was a foundation, an understanding that if you're going to have a republic, a democratic republic, you're going to have inner control, not control by government, but control within the human being who are citizens of the country. And that control comes from your absolute commitment that God is God. He's the ruler of the universe, and he is going to judge the quick and the dead at some point, that there's going to be an account. And that's why even we lawyers, when we call a witness to the stand, they're called to raise their right hand. At least they used to be. Do you now swear that this testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help me God. That was the protection, wasn't it?
Yeah, totally, 100%. I mean, if you look again at the Constitution, I mean, you take an oath of office, and the reason that the framers felt so confident to inscribe the various oath provisions for the different branches of government was because they, like John Adams, in the quote that you just said, they presumed that they were going to have a religious and moral people who took the entire act of making and taking oaths quite seriously. So all that we have today is predicated upon that, all of it. You simply cannot have a people that is able to live with the liberties and freedoms that we have long had in this country. You simply cannot have that unless you have a religious bedrock, because in order to prevent that liberty from going down towards the paths of licentiousness or libertinism,
right.
And immorality and vice, in order to ensure that is properly channeled and oriented towards virtue and good and flourishing, you necessarily need a thumb on the scale, and that thumb on the scale was always supposed to be religion. But you know, unfortunately, I think many people in recent decades have forgotten that, and it's not just the secular nihilists, although that is a big part of the problem as well. But it's the rise of this new neo-Marxist woke ideology. You know, frankly, I think even some people on the right of center have started to drift a little bit further and further away from a deeply religiously inspired strand of conservatism.
I will go a lot further than that, and I will say that they have virtually abandoned the fear of the Lord. We've abandoned the fear of the Lord. I go back to Psalm 25:14. The secret of the Lord is with those who fear him, and to them he will establish his covenant. Oh, The fear of the Lord. Do you know, Josh, that I have asked, I've had about 3,500 national guests on this program over the past 30 years. And I've asked many a pastor, when was the last time you can remember hearing the words, a God-fearing man? Could you remember that in the last 30 years? And not one pastor could remember it. I've asked parachurch leaders, can you remember anybody using that phrase? Yet that phrase used to be the most common phrase in this country used to describe a man who at least knew that he was accountable for his words and his behavior before God. That's our problem. We've lost the fear of the Lord in the land.
You said it extremely well. Look, in Judaism, fear of God Almighty is one of our bedrock principles. The Hebrew would be Yirat Shemayim, literally fear of the heavens, what that literally translates to. I mean, Yirat Shemayim is a foundational principle. I actually talk about Yirat Shemayim a lot in the penultimate chapter of my book, chapter 10, if I recall.
Well, I wrote a whole book on it called The Secret of the Lord, a whole book on it, because I feel that it's bedrock if there's any hope for this country.
1,000%. And look, one of the things that I'm hoping to accomplish with the new book that I've released is just trying to nudge people in a direction of getting back. I'm not trying to propose anything new. I think in the year 2025 to try to reinvent the wheel is kind of a paradigmatic act of hubris, frankly.
No, you're bringing the wheel back into perspective.
Right.
You're not reinventing anything. Neither am I.
Right, I'm fundamentally trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
There you go. All right, friends, I want to make this book available to you because you're going to find here is an Orthodox Jewish man, a lawyer. We have two lawyers now, one Christian, the other Orthodox Jew, who are seeking to plead the cause of God's authority in the land. And if that doesn't happen in America and in Israel to unite us, then what do we have to unite us? Money? Here's the book. It's a $32 hardbound book, yours for $28 on our website today. Israel and Civilization. I hope you'll get it. I hope you will get it and read it from your heart and then tell others about it. Go to the website, saveus.org, saveus.org. Call us at 1-800-SAVE-USA. That's 1-800-SAVE-USA. Or write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Writing a check and $6 for postage and handling. Josh, you might wonder, well, you call it Save America Ministries. What do you mean by that? Well, let me tell you, it's not about the political salvation of the country, because the politics have to flow from the life of the people. It's about the spiritual and religious foundation of the country. That's what we talk about the most here on this program. And everything else is downhill from that. What would you say?
I think that's very well said, actually. I mean, along the lines of all the quotes we've already described, Washington, Adams, there, you have to know where you're starting from in order to then deduce secondary and tertiary policy conclusions there. But the entire notion of having a free society that debates policy issues makes little sense unless you have an exogenous pre-existing framework in order to entertain those debates and ultimately trying to arrive at the truth. But you have to have a starting place on which to stand. And yeah, for, you know, many generations, for hundreds of years, for many Westerners, for thousands of years, that starting place was the Bible. And the Bible, frankly, in many ways, is what made Western civilization the force that it is. And there's so much in there, right? I mean, again, we could talk for hours about that there. But I mean, one could plausibly argue that such things as the entire notion of private property rights actually has an origin in the Bible. In fact, in the Talmud, which is essentially just the oral Torah, it's the complement to the written word of God, our oral Torah, the Talmud, there are literally entire tractates explicating all the minutiae of private property. So think about private property and economic freedom and all that is done for prosperity. I mean, frankly, that has biblical roots as well. So much like that, Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, the divine image imperative. I argue in the book that the notion that God made man his image, that is actually the singular underlying wellspring of all of of all contemporary thought.
In fact, Genesis 1 through 3 kind of lay out all the foundations, the creation ordinances of God, including marriage itself, and we've desecrated that. Both in America and in Israel. I remember about 15 years ago reading an article that I used on the program and also quoted in one of my books from, I think it was the Jerusalem Post, was reporting that the divorce rate in Israel was rapidly following in the jet stream of America, and at that time had reached 30%. That's a pretty grave thing for Israel, isn't it?
In my judgment, what the children of Israel, like the, in other words, the Jewish people, the nation of Israel, the children of Israel, what we are fundamentally called to do, again, this notion of the book of Isaiah, light unto the nations, Exodus, kingdom of priests, what we're called to do is to be a holy nation.
Right.
And ideally, the capital state of Israel, the modern state, would reflect that as well. So any time that you have Jews that are not acting in a holy manner. And to be clear, that has existed literally since the Bible as well. I mean,
it's undermining the very purpose, the very calling of the people.
Exactly.
The same is true for Gentile Christians. Exactly the same issue. So we're at a crossroads, and the crossroads we're at fundamentally is not primarily political, it's spiritual.
It absolutely is.
All right. We'll be back after this, friends. Josh and I are somewhat restrained here because as lawyers, we want to get to all of the meat, everything that's available, and we don't have time to do that. We're laying enough here so that you can understand where we're going. $28 will put his wonderful book in your hands. It's on our website, saveus.org. I hope you'll get it.
There is so much more about Chuck Crismeyer and Save America Ministries on our website, saveus.org. For example, on the front page are two great videos. First, an interview and discussion of Chuck's book, Out of Egypt. Also, a great TV interview with Chuck regarding his book, Seduction of the Saints. Much more videos, a For Pastors Only section, and also you can view Chuck's weekly teachings, all at his website, saveus.org. That's saveus.org. Also on Chuck's website, listen to Chuck's Viewpoint broadcast. Listen to the archives. Maybe you missed a program. Check it out at saveus.org. Also, there are some great resources, hospitality information, also information about marriage, divorce, and remarriage, newsletters, articles, prophecy, prayer and revival information, all at saveus.org.
Again, I welcome you back to Viewpoint. I'm Chuck Crismeyer. As you know, and we say every day, viewpoint determines destiny. And our viewpoint on these issues that we're talking about today, that Josh is bringing up, that I'm bringing up, is determining destiny, and that's why we're at a crossroads. What will that destiny be? Well, chapter 6 of his book is titled The State of Israel, The Western World's Indispensable Bulwark. Indispensable bulwark. Well, a bulwark is something that stands against the onslaught of opposition. Yet opposition comes in the form of anti-Zionism, which was Zionism was the force with Theodore Herzl and so on back in the late 1800s that drove Israel increasingly toward the state of Israel, the establishment of the state of Israel. And yet even within the United States State Department at the time of the formation of the state of Israel in 1948, the disposition was so anti-Israel that Truman, who was not exactly a God lover, decided, you know what? I have to do this. I have to recognize the state of Israel. This is necessary. But within Israel, you have many Jewish leaders who say, this is not godly, it's not good. We shouldn't be raising up the state of Israel. We should wait for the Messiah to do it. What say you, Josh?
Well, this is a genuine intra-Judaism theological debate.
But it has practical implications, political implications.
Yes and no. So I talk about this a little bit in one of the latter chapters of the book. So yes, on the extreme fringes. So you have, like, for instance, a group called Netzer Karta. They were formed as an offshoot of a Hasidic group called Satmar years ago. These are the lunatics who made a big stink about 20 years ago, flying to Tehran to meet with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. They're the people flying the Palestinian flag. This is a tiny, 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 tiny percentage of the Orthodox population. They're basically the Jewish equivalent of the Westboro Baptist Church. It's kind of like the way that I would put it there. now there are there are many Haredi. The media calls them ultra-Orthodox. I prefer the term Haredi. There are many Haredi Jews who theologically do not believe that the state of Israel should have been formed, and they would not call themselves nationalists today.
In other words, they don't believe the state of Israel is really legit.
Correct, because of essentially the reason that you said, which is that the logic is that the Jewish Messiah should come, and then we will all recongregate back in our land there. But for practical purposes, here's the point. And my brother-in-law is actually an example of this. He is exactly this. He is a Haredi Jew who does not believe in the theological legitimacy of the contemporary state of Israel. But nonetheless, his views on Israeli-Arab relations when it comes to Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, the so-called two-state solution with the Palestinian Arabs, his views on all these issues are essentially indistinguishable from mine.
In other words, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right, but it's even more basic than that, actually. I mean, even if you don't believe in the nationalist legitimacy of the state of Israel, if you are a Jew, you still have to care about the fate of Jewry, of the global Jewish population. And at this point, half or more than half the world's Jews live in this tiny state there. So you have to care about the security of that state.
All right. Well, the same issue now deals with the issue of the rebuilding of a third temple. many within the Jewish community, particularly in Israel, are anticipating the rebuilding of a temple. Certainly, they believe that we're in the what they would call the Messianic Age. 30 years ago, only about 16 to 20% believe that. Now, about 65% believe that. But what that looks like and how it's defined is not necessarily unified in Israel. However, with regard to the rebuilding of the temple, my understanding is that there's a great division. Some say, well, we've got to have the temple because it's the single most thing that unites the mind and heart of Israel. Others say, yes, we agree with that, but we can't build it. We got to wait for the Messiah to come and build it. What say you?
Look, we literally, Orthodox Jews, religious Jews, pray three times a day, four times a day on the Sabbath and Rosh Chodesh, the first days of the month, but three to four times a day. We always pray for the restoration of Jerusalem and rebuilding of the temple. I literally pray for that three times a day. So anyone, any Jew who can call himself a Jew with a straight face, who has any Yirat Shemayim, any fear of heaven, any fear of the Lord, and who does not believe that the temple has to be reconstituted, I frankly have no idea what that person will be talking about, actually. I mean, the temple was the bedrock of Judaism for millennia until both were tragically destroyed. We pray for its restoration every day.
Well, it's both the cultural and religious epicenter.
Correct. Yeah. Of the 613 commandments that Jews are obligated to, we are unable to fulfill over 200 of them, I forgot the exact number, but over 200 of them directly involve the temple. So right. We literally are not capable of fully fulfilling our Torah biblical obligations unless right. and until
so the rabbis had to devise alternative means to try to at least give a, shall we say, a representative fulfillment that wasn't really a fulfillment.
Yeah, exactly right. So yeah. To give like one very concrete example of that, so back at the time of the temple, there would be daily sacrifices. There would be the Tamid sacrifice, the continual offering every morning and every afternoon. So instead of that, in lieu of that there, we just read the scriptural verses and, right. and the accompanying Talmudic statements of the rabbis there, because the rabbis ruled at some point, you know, a millennium and a half ago, that was the best that we could come, and therefore that we would fulfill our Torah obligation.
And fulfill by good works to fulfill tikkun olam.
Yeah, and tikkun olam, incidentally, is a concept that has been completely destroyed by theologically liberal Reform Jews. They take this very noble term of tikkun olam, which means repair the world.
Right.
But the actual meaning of tikkun olam, which is a fairly abstruse term from the Talmud, the actual meaning of it is to repair the world through doing the commandments, through doing the mitzvot, through being right. a light unto the nations, to again quote yeah. Isaiah there. But the lefty, theologically liberal Jews take it to mean environmental justice and global warming and open borders for immigrants and abortion on demand.
Well, we have exactly the same thing that's been taken over by the mainline churches in this country. Ever since the early 1900s, it's been a gradual process, just like it's been there in Israel. In fact, I'm remembering, it was about maybe 12 years ago, I was asked by a conservative rabbi, when I say conservative, I mean of the conservative Jewish ilk at that time, and he was the head of a congregation, and he asked me to participate and read a scripture at this bar mitzvah. And afterward, you know, we had a meal celebration and that kind of thing. And he came up to me and he said this. He said, "We don't do that Deuteronomic thing." And he was really sarcastic about it. "We don't do that Deuteronomic thing." What he was talking about is, we don't believe in obeying God and all of the things that are required there in the, shall we say, the restatement of the rest of the Torah in the book of Deuteronomy. We don't believe in that. What say you?
I mean, that's horrifying, but I'll give you another example that's possibly even starker, actually. So one of my best friends is another formerly not religious turned Orthodox Jew. His name is Adam Klausman, dear friend of mine. He lives out in Scottsdale, Arizona. He was formerly in the Arizona State Legislature. Now he serves on the Scottsdale City Council.
So
he was one of the leading, one of the leaders there on the Scottsdale City Council trying to promulgate an anti-DEI resolution, anti-diversity, equity, mm-hmm, inclusion mm-hmm. resolution in Scottsdale. And a group of Reform Jews showed up to protest Adam. And as a token of good faith, because this was in the afternoon, to try to be inclusive there and just try to show that we're really all here, all on the same team, my friend Adam proposed to the rabbi of this Reform temple, they would call it, the Reform synagogue. He said, would you join me in a prayer of Mincha? That's a daily afternoon prayer for Jews. And I kid you not, apparently what the rabbi said back to my friend Adam was, he said, DEI is my Mincha. Which is,
in other words, a complete substitute, a complete revised, reformed religion.
Right. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I hear that, and to me, that's just idolatry. I mean, that ceases to be religion, and that's no longer monotheism. That is just paganism, idolatry, the likes of which monotheism was promulgated to oppose.
All right.
In the first
so,
place.
What you're actually describing then, through one incident, is what has taken place culturally across our country and in many respects throughout the entire Western world. And this is why we're at the crossroads. This is why we're at the crossroads, because there is no respect for the authority of God and his word. In fact, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but on April 5th, 1993, Time Magazine, I know you're with Newsweek, but Time Magazine came out with what I think is one of the most powerful covers ever in its history. On the front was a cover, it was a cross, lots of people's faces on it. And then in the lower right-hand corner, it said this, the generation that forgot God. Now, it wasn't talking about the generation that was going to forget God. It was talking about the generation that already had. That was in 1993, as people were flooding back to church. Well, here's what Time Magazine said. The reason people are flooding back to church, but the church will never again be the same, is because Americans are looking for a custom-made God, one made in their own image. Don't you think that also would be true within the Jewish realm?
Absolutely. And that's very well said, actually. It's a very powerful quote. But there is this broader inversion of Genesis 1:27, isn't there? I mean, 1:27 very clearly says that God made man in his image, but
right.
You have a lot of theologically liberal Jews, Christians, perhaps other religions as well, that increasingly want to make the divine, the creator, simply out to be in their own image. And that is really just coming from a place of supreme hubris. Frankly, of solipsism.
It's called chutzpah.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, friends, the book Israel and Civilization. You can tell Josh and I are really into it here, and we've got so much more to talk about in the balance of the program. The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. $28 will put this $32 book in your hands. It's on our website, saveus.org. Get a copy.
Have you ever considered what the early church was like? Many people are developing a heart longing for greater fulfillment in our practices as Christians. A recent study showed 53,000 people a week are leaving the back door of America's churches in frustration. What is going on? Why has there not been even a 1% gain among followers of Christ in the last 25 years? Could it be that God is seeking to restore first century Christianity for the 21st century? Jesus said, I'll build my church. Is Christ by his Spirit stirring to prepare the church for the 21st century? The early church prayed together and broke bread from house to house. They were family, and it was said by all who observed, behold how they love one another. Incredible.
But the same can be found right now. Go to saveus.org and click Sell Church. We can revive first century Christianity for the 21st century.
It's about people, not programs. It's about a body, not a building.
That's saveus.org. Click Sell Church.
Again, I want to make sure you get a copy of Josh's book. It's a $32 hardbound book, Israel and Civilization, the fate of the Jewish nation and the destiny of the West. Again, it's on our website, saveus.org. You should call us at 1-800-SAVE-USA. That's 1-800-SAVE-USA. Or write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. $6 for postage and handling, we'll get it in your hands. All right. One of the things that has been hot in the news for the past several years and is heating up in different ways now as our current president is withdrawing funds from America's major universities over anti-Semitism is this chapter title, Anti-Zionism, a Most Fashionable Anti-Semitism. What is anti-Zionism and why is that a fashionable anti-Semitism, Josh?
Well, yet again, it kind of gets back to our need to define terms here. So right. Let's stipulate what anti-Zionism is and what it is not. A lot of people like to strawman this particular debate. They like to say, oh, you can't criticize the government of Israel. You're not allowed to criticize Israeli policies. I see a lot of people on social media saying this kind of blather. I mean, nothing could be further from the case. I assure you, as someone whose wife is Israeli, I assure you that no one criticizes the Israeli government more vociferously than Israelis themselves. I mean, they have...
Well, I understand that where there are two Israelis, there are at least three or four opinions, so...
Yeah, exactly. Israel's political system is completely bonkers. They have 15 to 20 political parties. It's an extremely fractious political legal situation. So anyone who says you're not allowed to criticize the policies of Prime Minister Barak, Olmert, Netanyahu, Sharon, whoever, that's totally not true. What actual anti-Zionism is in the year 2025 is a practical call for the eradication of the state of Israel. That's what it amounts to in the year 2025. Now, here's what I will say. I'm even willing to go a little further than that. If you are a true John Lennon imagined George Soros style globalist who fundamentally rejects the entire notion of a nation state, and if your stance is that you want to eradicate the state of Israel just as you want to eradicate the United States, Paraguay, Indonesia, Japan, Papua New Guinea, you name it, then I'm not going to call you an anti-Semite for that because you're being consistent. But if the majority of your attention seems to be preoccupied for calling for the idiosyncratic eradication of one tiny, tiny nation state, and that tiny nation state happens to be the world's only Jewish state, then yes, I'm going to attribute that to anti-Semitism.
All right. And I would agree with that because at the root of it is we don't want that particular people group to exist on the face of the planet. You're nothing but troublemakers, which leads us to a biblical authority that helps to support that notion to a certain extent. If you go back to Numbers chapter 23 and 24, you have a fella that we, in our American view, call it Balaam. You call it Balaam, I think. But anyway, here's a guy that tried to get himself out from under the will of God, pray himself out from under the will of God five times. And finally, God got his attention by crushing his foot by the donkey he was riding on and then speaking to him. That donkey must be a lawyer in advance to be able to speak to the guy. But anyway, he did. And ultimately, Balaam came to the confrontation and the resolution from God that the Jewish people would never be recognized among the nations, would never be, they were to be a called out people, not recognized among the nations. Question, why then has Israel always wanted to be recognized among the nations if you're under biblical authority?
Well, unfortunately, the current state of Israel, I'm not
That's
sure.
A tough question, isn't it?
It is a tough question, but unfortunately, I think there's a modest percentage, shall we say, of contemporary Israelis who view themselves as living under biblical authority. Israel, look, It is not a wholly secular state. Anyone who would call it that is not accurate.
So,
for instance, these state-run schools do teach a little Bible, Torah. So there's not this erroneous notion of so-called separation of church and state, which, by the way, is a historical lie when it comes to the United States. But
true.
You know, neither here nor there for present purposes. But in Israel, they definitely do have a little religion infused into the public square, for sure. But it's also not an observant state. For instance, you have buses in Tel Aviv, frankly, even some buses in Jerusalem, which is the holiest city, that will operate, for instance, on the Jewish Sabbath. You'll have restaurants in Tel Aviv that will sell shellfish, pork, and so forth there in violation of the laws of kosher.
Well, Tel Aviv is kind of like the Sodom of Israel.
That's a very funny and colorful way to describe it, but yeah, I mean you're not wrong. Yeah. It happens to be a beautiful city.
I agree.
But it's
so was Sodom. That's why Lot pitched his tent there.
Right. Tel Aviv is essentially a European style city that happens to be there on the Mediterranean, like other great European cities like Barcelona, Spain, and so forth. There,
right.
But the heart of Israel, certainly when I go to Israel, as I'm going to do, God willing, again in just a few weeks now for my wife's cousin's wedding, for me, no trip to Israel is complete without going to Jerusalem, because that really is the heart and soul of the Jewish people. I mean, we pray for the restoration of Jerusalem again three times a day. That is our eternal home. And to me, that, you know, all these political debates about the status of Jerusalem, it's almost funny to me to hear it debated as a political matter, because for us, this is not a matter of politics. It's
exactly.
A matter of just who we are as human beings.
Exactly. Okay, let's go to Psalm 2 for a moment. A lot of people won't go there. They don't think of it as a prophetic psalm. I think it's one of the most important prophetic psalms. It says, "Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain and foolish thing? The kings of the earth are coming together, confederating together against the Lord and against his anointed," which, by the way, is Israel, and saying, "Let's tear their bands asunder." And God's going to laugh at them. He's going to have them in derision. And then he responds by saying, "Hey, guys, I've already set my king on my holy hill." Don't you get it? From my perspective, God says, why should you even try to get dominion over the Temple Mount? I've already set my king on my holy hill, so you guys might better consider, kiss the sun, it says, lest you be destroyed in your efforts to try to take dominion over the Temple Mount. Very, very powerful psalm. Now, that brings up the issue of the Temple Mount, which is, shall we say, the epicenter of Jerusalem, some would say the center of the world, and Maimonides, who said that whoever helps build the Temple Mount, or the temple, the rebuild temple on the Temple Mount, will have to be the Messiah. That's what he said. What do you say?
Well, yes, the Temple Mount, as we call it in Hebrew, Har Habayit, I mean, that is the hub of the hub. Our tradition teaches us that is actually where the world was created, was created right there on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. You know, right. there's an interesting halakhic, that is to say, Jewish legal debate today as to what the status is of Jews who wish to go and pray on the Temple Mount.
Right.
So most Haredi Jews, so-called ultra-Orthodox Jews, would not do so, actually, because there are some poskim, there are some Jewish rabbinical scholars who say that you're not allowed to do that until the temple is properly reconstituted. But most,
in other words, until the Messiah builds the temple.
Correct.
Right.
But most of the in Israel, they would call the kippa strugah crowd, the folks who wear the knit kippas. We might call them modern Orthodox here, religious Zionists.
Mm-hmm.
Those folks like Itamar Ben-Gvir and the government, they would have no compunction going up there. I have to confess to you that I have a huge soft spot for the Temple Mount activists. So to give you an example,
right,
just a few days ago, earlier this week on Monday, was Pesach Sheni, or the second Passover, because it's 1 month after the original Passover.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, the Torah describes this in the book of Numbers and says that if you are ritually impure and cannot partake in the sacrifice of the Paschal lamb at the first Passover, then you essentially have a makeup opportunity 1 month later. So we had that this past Monday. And there were actually, I think it was 7 Orthodox Jewish activists from Judea and Samaria who were actually arrested for trying to smuggle a live goat onto the Temple Mount to try to sacrifice the goat. They were trying to hide this goat in some supermarket bags. I'm not sure how they thought they could get away with that. But I have to say, I genuinely admire the efforts, to be honest with you.
So they would have been considered Temple Mount terrorists then?
Certainly in the eyes of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, right. Palestinian Authority crowd. That is
okay, so this is becoming an increasingly serious issue of focus with a new pope having been elected. The papacy has already declared in writing their intent to rule and reign from the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Not from the Vatican, but from the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. People won't talk about it because they're afraid to talk about it because it goes against ecumenicalism. But that's exactly the truth. So this issue concerning the Temple Mount is probably the most fractious issue ever in the history of humankind. How in the world do Jews and Gentiles, particularly the Western world and America, how do we deal with that? Because it's fundamentally a religious and spiritual issue, but it has immeasurable political ramifications. What say you?
Look, one of the core arguments of the book is that the West is stronger when the Bible is stronger, and the Bible can only be strong when both the original people of the book, the Jewish right. people, and the great Gentile offshoot Christian, when both of us are strong as well.
I agree with that wholeheartedly and give you a holy hug over that statement.
And in order for the Jewish people to be strong, in turn, we need our temple. Because that without the temple, Judaism is incomplete. We've been incomplete for almost 2,000 years now, since the Romans burned down the Second Temple in the year 70. So we are unable to fully discharge our duties to be a light unto the nation, as we are called to do, absent the temple, through which alone we can fulfill over 200 of our 613 commandments.
Mm-hmm.
So for that reason alone, I think that all Bible lovers, all Jews, all Christians should pray for the restoration of the temple. By the way, there was this wonderful video clip of Pete Hegseth, our defense secretary, speaking at a conference at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem maybe 5-6 years ago or so, where he basically says that, actually. He says that he prays for the restoration of the Third Temple. Actually.
I saw that. I had not been aware of that initially, but I just saw it yesterday.
It was a fascinating clip. I was kind of caught off guard when I saw it because it seemed like it was coming so from the heart. It was actually quite beautiful.
Yeah. All right. So, Josh, as we're here, ready to wrap up here, we need to make a closing argument. A couple of attorneys here. We need to make a closing argument. And what would be your persuasive argument, your passionate statement coming from your heart to fulfill the purpose of your book, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West?
So we're facing three hegemonic forces that seek to destroy us. In no particular order, they are wokeism, Islamism, and global neoliberalism. In order to have any chance of fighting back against that which seeks to destroy you, you have to first know what you stand for. We stand for the Bible. Mm-hmm. Jews and Christians share a biblical inheritance. We are right. stronger together. And at a crossroads, a very dangerous inflection point like this,
yeah.
we necessarily have to link arms and stand lockstep like never before to fight back against terrible
All right,
forces.
We've got to restore the authority of God and His Word. That's really what we've got to do. And the fear of the Lord is at the heart of it. Israel and Civilization, friends, $28 will put this fantastic book in your hands. You don't want to miss out. Call us 1-800-SAVE-USA. Write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Add $6 for postage and handling and become a partner. Friends, can you see that we're confronting the deepest issues of our hearts and homes? Please seriously consider becoming a partner. Help us to get the message out and to prepare the way of the Lord. God bless.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismier. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.